You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today, we are in Valence.
Well, we were played in there by some Colombian cycling fans singing at the finish in Valence on Colombian Independence Day. Obviously, lots of riders for them to cheer. They were mainly cheering Darwin Atapuma today, but there's quite a few for them to cheer. No Rigoberto Urán, of course, who pulled out yesterday. But where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in Valence. We're in a restaurant in Valence. The doors are open. You may be able to hear the rain or the traffic driving on the very wet roads outside, because it's been a really hot, muggy day here, very, very humid. And this evening the heavens have opened and it's, well, it's still very warm, but it is, well, it's raining quite heavily now, isn't it? But we're indoors, nice and dry, and just behind Richard on the wall is painted yellow, and there is a very nice old bicycle. It's not really a working bicycle, it's a kind of a model of a bicycle. Got a very big front chain ring. That's probably about a 60 tooth chain ring. You could perhaps do the hour record on that bicycle.
Somebody maybe once did. Any famous cyclist from Valence, Francois? Sorry, I just sprung that on you.
Charlie Motet lives, is from the area.
Well, today we passed through Vizille just before Grenoble, which was the hometown of Thierry Claverolla.
Absolutely.
The late Thierry Claverolla.
The eagle of Vizille, who committed suicide. I think we'd already mentioned
it. We talked about that. But
yeah, absolutely.
I remember one of his most famous performances was on Alpe d'Huez, when he yo-yoed off the back and kept coming back to the group and sometime in the early
90s. Absolutely. He won the Polka de Jerseys, the jersey twice, and won a, well, a fame, I think his most striking victory, if I remember well, was in Morzine 1 year. And yeah, I mean, his fate unfortunately was tragic, because he had money problems, opened a bar, and then had a car accident, and which indirectly causes suicide. We're talking about Colombians. Do you know that the first rider to win a Tour de France stage in Valence was Colombian?
Chepe Gonzalez.
Absolutely
in
right.
In 1994.
Absolutely right. Right.
Well done, me. Mm.
So, yeah, I was about to ask the question to our dear listeners, just to see if somebody found. But Lionel, you too. Yeah, I mean, you know.
So I win a RAFA jersey and a year's supply of Science in Sport products.
Actually, we do need to declare a winner of our Find Peter Sagan a Nickname competition to win a copy of Carte de Tour, the Paul Fournel book.
Why don't we do that in one of our press conference episodes? We're actually behind on the press conference. We've had loads of great questions.
The listeners about what's happening.
Yeah,
with that.
But have we decided yet?
Yes.
Okay, well, why don't you update?
Okay, on Monday. So we didn't, because of the long journey on the rest day, we didn't get to record our press conference episode. So on Monday, we're basically going to do two and release maybe both of them, but maybe we'll keep one until after the tour. We haven't decided that yet, but we've got a lot of questions from last week and we're going to get through them. Please send us questions relating to this week or relating to anything. If you call the WhatsApp number or leave a voice memo on our WhatsApp number, which is, Lionel, do you have it handy? It's on our Twitter profile, so
it is on our Twitter profile. Yes, Richard, I've got it very handy. It's +44 797 133 8205. +44 797 133 8205.
So we'll sit down on Monday and do a lengthy session of listening to and answering questions as best we can. Some really good ones, actually, from last week. Some quite funny ones. Some some pretty insulting ones.
Great. But that's I'm fine. Looking forward to returning those insulting questions back with a little bit of interest as I
bit a bit of top spin, spin, yeah.
Bit of top spin as I
let's get on with the stage then, Lionel, the tale of the attack.
Well, this may not take long. Stage 13 from Bourg d'Oisans to Valence, 169.5 kilometres. The break, four-man break of Thomas de Gendt of Lotto Soudal, Tom Scully of EF Education First, Dimitri Kleiss of Cofidis, and Michael Scher of BMC Racing. Well, they were away most of the day. We saw Bora Hansgrohe chasing a bit, Groupama FDJ chasing a bit. Really not many sprinters left in the Tour after, as I described it yesterday, the bonfire of the sprinters in the Alps. Michael Scher was the last rider out in front on his own, but he was caught with around 6 kilometres to go. Inside the final kilometre, Philippe Gilbert, a quick step, tried to take a flyer. Looked pretty good for a short while, but the peloton was right back on them. And then the sprint finish really was between the four best sprinters left in the race. And Peter Sagan won. It was closer than you might have expected. Sagan, Alexander Kristoff and Arnaud Démare were very close together, with John Degenkolb in fourth and Greg Van Avermaet in fifth. That is Peter Sagan's 11th Tour de France stage win. It means he's now level with Andre Greipel in the list of all-time stage winners, and one behind Eric Zabel, Robbie McEwen and Mario Cipollini, and three behind Kittel. Still some way off Eddie Merckx's 34 or even Mark Cavendish's 30. But I was looking back at his stage wins over the years. He's been second 21 times in the Tour de France. Quite an extraordinary statistic, that. And third 10 times. That just shows, you know, how kind of consistent he is. The only other notable thing from the results is that Adam Yates, Bauke Mollema, Domenico Pozzovivo are all off the back in a group that lost nearly a minute and a half. Not that that has a great deal of impact on the GC, but notable. No changes overall. Geraint Thomas still in yellow. Peter Sagan is in green. 398 points he's got. 228 points ahead of Alexander Kristoff. Alaphilippe is still in the King of the Mountains jersey, and Pierre Latour, who is from Romans-sur-Isère, yeah, just down the road, yeah, is still in the white jersey.
I've got just one small point to make, since you kept correcting our spelling of Stephen Kay yesterday. Is it Michael Scher? I mean, he's Swiss-German, so it should be Michel Scher, I suppose. It was just to make a point.
Well,
where's Rob Hatch when you need him?
Yeah, the pronunciation police, I mean, they're everywhere. So, yeah, tweet us. Do tweet us correcting us.
Yeah, nobody needs any encouragement to do that. The big news, though, overnight, and it came too late for last night's podcast, was Vincenzo Nibali. We all saw him fall on Alpdes, or rather, we didn't see him fall, but we saw him on the ground having fallen. And he was on the ground for quite a while and chased to within 13 seconds of that front group, which was really a remarkable performance. But he looked quite badly hurt on the ground, and he clearly was badly injured because he was taken to hospital in Grenoble for a scan, which revealed a fractured vertebra. So he is out of the Tour.
Yep. I mean, what a strong ride to get back to within touching distance of that group. There was a whole debate, well, surely Nibali should have the same time as the group that he was in when the incident happened. This morning, everyone was still trying to work out what had happened, and I spoke to Bahrain Merida's sports director, Rick Verbrugge. Rick, can you clear up what happened to Vincenzo Nibali on Alpe d'Huez yesterday?
Not space enough. Motorbikes were passing on the left side, and they were there actually for giving the security what they tried to do. It's not that I'm complaining about this. But for that reason, Vincenzo needs to go more on the side of the road, closer to the public. And what's happened. So I think how you say that, the sangle from a camera.
The strap from a camera,
strap,
yeah.
Strap from a camera.
Caught on his handlebars.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, himself didn't exactly know what's happened, which is so quickly. And so, but afterwards, you can see it on some image that you find on the net. It changed everything for the team. So you lost your leader. You need to think on another way. But we are still here also. The guys are motivated and wants to show to Vincenzo that he had a strong team around him, that the goal that he was coming to the Tour, that the team will support him. And now it's up to them to show that we are still there.
When he hit the ground, he looked quite badly hurt, but then he almost caught the group again. It was an incredible ride. I mean, did you hope maybe he's okay?
Yeah, that was my main thing. So I knew that he went to the hospital to do some extra x-ray or exams, whatever. But the thing was that when he started again, he had a gap of 40 seconds and he came back to 13 seconds. It meant that he was strong, that he could maybe win the stage. Do that reason, I was always thinking that, okay, he went to the hospital, but if he was so strong, maybe it will be okay. So let's hope for tonight, but that came the bad news from the doctor.
You can't ride the Tour de France with a fractured vertebrae.
No, it's too dangerous. You need to give it some rest. I think maybe it could do it, but if you crash again, then it's for the rest of your life, maybe. So no, this risk, it's impossible to take.
Very, very bad luck. The crowds on Alpe d'Huez seem to be smaller than in some years recently. What's the answer, though? Because we see these situations. Chris Froome on Mont Ventoux a couple of years ago, the crowds get too close. This was just a freak accident, but somebody with their camera in a position where the riders might catch it. What is the answer?
Yeah, it looks like it was less cruel than in the other years, and I had that feeling also when I went with the car up to there. But it's still, you need sometimes only one person that do a small mistake and then have a big consequence. So I spoke this morning also to the police that try to give the security to the riders. They apologize also if it's not them fault properly. But we need to start a discussion between teams, police, organization, UCI, to do something, to have less motorbikes on the race, to make the job easier for the riders to do their job. And I think that's something really important for the future for cycling. But otherwise, you lost maybe your champion do stupid things like this.
Yeah, and I spoke to Vincenzo Nibali's teammate and roommate on this tour, Franco Pellizzotti. As I mentioned, Nibali was taken to hospital in Grenoble. He then came back to the hotel on the top of Alpe d'Huez quite late last night, stayed in the hotel, stayed in the room with Franco Pellizzotti. I did ask Ciro Scognamiglio, of course, Nibali's shadow, whether he had been at the hotel last night, whether he'd spoken to Nibali, and Ciro replied, yes, I stayed in the hotel. So I don't know how long Ciro remained at
all night, probably.
Nibali's door. But anyway, it's a lovely picture. Franco Pellizzotti, though, this morning told me a little bit about Nibali and his mood and his plans to get back racing quite soon.
It's normally Vincenzo is the captain for the GC, but for the Team Bahrain Merida now is a change this tour day by day today. When Vincenzo finished the stage, it's difficult for him because the more sacrifice this last month is finishing in 1 second. When shows is the crash in Roubaix, it's normal, not normally, but okay, more risk, but the crash in this not possible. But not angry, but disappointed for this. Now, important recovery, but we speak with the doctor of the team, and maybe, yes, the same program of before, Vuelta and Mondiale, World Championship.
A real shame for Nibali and for the race that he was lying fourth overall. His legs obviously were plenty strong enough to be able to ride back into more or less touching distance of the main GC riders. But Rich, this morning the picture was still a bit fuzzy of what had happened. There were lots of photographs floating around. There was somebody had let off a flare, so there was a lot of yellow smoke around. It was all a bit kind of grassy knoll, wasn't it? Pictures of Nibali and the camera strap that may well have been the culprit, but today some clearer images have emerged, I gather.
Yeah, I mean, there was, I think it was a red flare actually that had gone off. There was a yellow flare thrown into the peloton today, quite close to the finish. Geraint Thomas was asked about that after the stage. Very clear footage of the perpetrator, which, you know, with these stages broadcast live from start to finish, if you're going to do something like that, you are going to be picked up by a camera somewhere. So it's a very risky thing to do. But yeah, there was a lot of confusion at that point. It was pretty tight. There were these roped off barriers, and Nibali was obviously riding quite close to the crowd, but he had little choice. And you can see where there's a very reminiscent of the Lance Armstrong crash in 2003 on Luz Ardiden, when he caught his handlebars in a child's bag on that occasion.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
I'm Simon from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that riding's the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world, and we host 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. See rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
There was an interesting thing happening this morning when I was at the podium this morning talking to riders, that there was distinctly heard a guy from France Television saying that Romain Bardet wanted to be invited on TV to make a statement, not in any official way, but you know he obviously took it upon him as the French favorite to take a clear stance on these security issues, the flares, the crashes, and so he did this morning talk about it, and he in French when I was at the podium, and then he did it again tonight. He was invited on French television, and had a very powerful speech about the security of the riders, saying that it was really a disgrace that Vincenzo Nibali should be out of contention for the Tour de France because of this sort of incident. He also obviously criticized the attitude of some of the public towards Chris Froome. I mean, we saw last night a fan, in brackets, tried to shove or push Chris Froome off his bike, and it really made it clear that the Tour should remain a popular event. But he said, and he kind of warned the fans, if you go on like this, and we saw yesterday on L'Alpe d'Huez, because I've been on L'Alpe d'Huez since 1986. I'd never seen so many barriers, and maybe one day, if these kind of things keep happening, we may see L'Alpe d'Huez barriered from start to finish, which would be the end of this proximity with the riders and the peloton. And Bardet was saying it would be a great shame, but if someday we need to get there, unfortunately we'll have to get there.
I spoke briefly to the Team Sky doctor this morning, and he said Chris Froome had been punched quite hard. I think he'd been hurt by that assault that we all saw. There was somebody arrested for that. I'm not sure what happened to him, but they are so vulnerable. And I was amazed today to see some people on Twitter and elsewhere suggesting that the riders had somehow brought this on themselves by their ethics or their morals. I mean, they are. In those moments, they're making a huge, huge effort. They're at their limit physically. Mm. And even when people get in their way, I think it's disrespectful. Mm. And, the Tour has gone, these mountain stages have gone, if you watch old footage, the spectators are there to watch the race. Mm. And they you can see they part as the riders appear. Sometimes they maybe do get a bit close. We've seen that before with cameras and so on. But nowadays, a lot of people seem to be there to get on TV themselves. Mm. And this is the big change. And this is what makes it even more dangerous. And you can never eliminate the danger because you've got public roads, you've got people standing on the road, and you've got riders going through them. So you never eliminate all the danger. But some fans, and it's certainly not all of them, the vast majority who are there to see the riders and to enjoy the occasion. But there are some people there who make it more dangerous.
Yeah, I feel pretty uneasy about talking about this kind of stuff because you don't want to inspire nutcases. I mean, I don't think any of our listeners are nutcases, so I think probably fairly safe here.
Well, might be one or two, I don't know.
No, but it's an awkward one because...
The one or two are not actually worth for the podcast, but...
But there is a huge unwritten contract of trust between the spectators and the riders, and the riders have to be confident that they can get through safely. And the incidents with the motorbikes, the irony that there are more motorbikes to secure the safety of the riders, more gendarmes, that was noticeable yesterday around that front group. Because of the Chris Froome Team Sky situation that everyone is aware of, but it's kind of trying to play down, More motorbikes means more congestion, means that everything comes to a head. But again, you know, this is nothing necessarily new. And I don't want to trump Francois here as the old man of the podcast. But I remember watching the 1988 tour on Alp d'Huez. Fabio Parra, Pedro Delgado, Stephen Rooks, Gert-Jan Tornise, I think, was the front group. Fabio Parra, Colombian rider, tried several times to attack, couldn't get through because of the motorbikes. Now, yeah, those motorbikes were photographers or TV
and the photographers
crew
couldn't get by because there was the crowd was there.
Exactly, yeah. So this is
Chiapucci on Sestri, same thing.
Guerini crashed when the year he won on Alpe d'Huez, he crashed because a spectator was taking a picture, so it's nothing new. But
that's right. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, these incidents have always happened. I mean, we only have to go back a couple of years. Chris Froome running up Mont Ventoux without his bike after a similar, much worse incident, but one created by the same circumstances. The issue of safety, the Tour is so vulnerable. And this is the bit that I feel a bit uncomfortable talking about, because we've seen the security effort really ramped up this year. I've noticed it from day one. The roads are closed from further away. A lot of agricultural traffic is used to, or vehicles are used to block the path. And obviously, because of the incident in Nice a couple of years ago, there is a concern that the Tour de France is vulnerable.
We know it's touchy subject, but I talked 2 years ago after the Nice incident. I had a long chat with the guy in charge of security for the Tour de France, Mr. Tuo, and so of course he didn't want to say too much, and I'm sure the setup is obviously shredding his secret, and he only told me what, you know, he could tell me, but it's obvious that the you know, when what we saw on L'Alpe d'Huez, I saw a couple of colleagues, thinking and writing it was to protect Team Sky and Chris Froome, which is in a way, kind of a way to single out Team Sky as different, and you know, and probably making them kind of foster the hostility of the public, when actually my impression is that all these security measures, and I know there are lots of plainclothes police in the crowd and all that, you know, have more to do with the Nice incident and other terror attacks in the past than with the cycling itself.
I must say, we must say that, you know, the irony here is that, like the Lance Armstrong case, when it was a young girl by the roadside and it was Armstrong's kind of fault, he got a bit too close. This was a photographer whose strap was hanging down. Now, That could have been just carelessness. This was not a malicious act.
No.
And I think this the guy who caused the crash will feel, I'm sure, terrible about it. So that's a point that's really worth making. And it was a really unfortunate incident. And it's deprived the race of an extra dimension in this third week, because Nibali is always better in the third week. His pedigree in Grand Tours is incredible. This is the first one he's ever packed, and he is, you know, he would have been a real protagonist in the final week, and I'm really sorry for the race that he's not here.
That's a point Bardet made as well, on top of, you know, defending the riders' safety and security. He said, well, and even in terms of, you know, for the fans of the race and the outcome of the race itself, you know, me and Nibali together and a couple of others, we could maybe try to unsettle Team Sky a little bit and make a more interesting race. But if you know, riders, contenders are out of the way on this kind of instances, it's even bad for the race, of course.
Yeah. Last point on this and sort of crowd behaviour. I was on Dutch Corner yesterday. That's been really unruly in the past. I made a kilometre zero about the change at Dutch Corner. Really kept under control by the police and also self-policed. And I think that, you know, the we've become accustomed to people in fancy dress running alongside the riders. I feel a bit uncomfortable about, because I think it's an accident waiting to happen. But people now are taking selfies or filming themselves backwards with the riders over their shoulder while running alongside. I mean, it's kind of upping the ante in terms of the potential for things to go wrong. And I just think, look, mate, you are not more important than the Tour de France. So, you know, if you're one of those wallies, just pack it in.
chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast from the Tour de France is sponsored by Harry's Razors. Now, if you would like to get your hands on a Harry's Razor set with German engineered blades and a beautifully weighted handle, you can do so for just £3.95 by going to harrys.com/cycling. Now, Rich, you've been using your Harry's Razor, but I gather, Francois, he'd run out of razor blades for his regular razor.
Well, Lionel, when we had a Harry's ad at the start of the Tour de France, we did say we would get the smoothest man in the press room, Francois, to try out a Harry's razor. I don't think Harry's are big in France yet. I'm not sure about that. But Francois, did it do the job?
It was the first time I tried an Harry's razors. I didn't even know they existed. And I'm quite, you know, as you say, I smooth and my skin is very sensitive. So I was a little bit worried that, you know, I might run into trouble. Well, I could hardly tell the difference between my normal brand and Harry's. So it was, you know, quite impressive in the first place because it has lots of blades. But it's actually pretty smooth. I could only see the difference with my normal brand. I might even change if Harry's come to France.
But it's like professional cyclists, isn't it? They're very particular about their bikes. You've used the same brand of razor for many years, Francois. Oh, yeah, so I understand your nervousness about switching.
Absolutely. Like for 15 years, I was like a rider, you know, has to change, you know, bikes in the middle of a stage and a teammate gives him his bike and you never know how it's going to unfold, and in this case, well, you know, the bike really suited my stride it was cool.
Well, Harry's, if you're listening, the French face of Harry's razors could be sitting here right beside us.
If you would like a weighted ergonomic handle with 5 precision engineered German engineered blades with lubricated strips, a rich lathering shave gel and travel blade cover, you can get your trial set now for £3.95. Go to harrys.com/cycling.
Hey, don't forget! You can listen to Kilometre Zero, our morning show, every weekday during the 2018 Tour de France. Kilometre Zero is supported by Hansgrohe.
So there was a stage today as well, of course. It was run by Peter Sagan. And I think we were warned on Twitter not to call it a classic transitional stage, but I'm afraid that's kind of what it was. Quite a lot of ground to cover in the next couple of days. Tomorrow's looking quite an interesting stage, but it was a stage that was run by Peter Sagan. I spoke at the finish to his teammate Lukas Postelberger, the Austrian rider riding his first Tour de France, pink jersey wearer at the Giro d'Italia last year, of course, Austrian champion. Who at one point, he did a lot of work on the front today, he was very visible, and at one point he appeared at the front of the bunch with about 16 kilometres to go, looking like he was wearing a fat suit, because he had so many bottles stuffed down the front, which I hadn't really seen before, and he was on bar duties there. But I spoke to him at the finish, here's what he had to say. We spoke to you on the eve of your first tour, and we've seen quite a lot of you on the front days like today. Can you tell us exactly what your job is?
The job is chasing, basically, so it's not that difficult. It's hard sometimes, but it's easy.
What was that like today, given that there's so few sprinters left in the race? Was there an extra responsibility on you and the team to help to bring it back together for Peter?
Yeah, after yesterday, so many guys had to leave the race, unfortunately, because of the time cut. So we said we take the responsibility from the beginning, try to control it. A little bit stressful because Thomas de Gendt is always a strong guy in the front, and also Michi Scherer was there. So we were trying to keep the distance as small as possible, but not too small that other guys try to go and attack in the late climbs. It worked out quite well, so we're happy. We win.
And how are you finding your first tour?
Yeah, it's fine till now. It's hard though. Not only the race, also all what's around and the traveling and all the media is quite big. So it's different, but I like it.
Is it a bit easier when you have someone like Peter Sagan on your team who can, you know, now that's his third stage win?
Yeah, it's if you know you can win almost every day, it's kind of motivation is pretty good. So yeah, I enjoy it till now.
So Postelberger there acknowledging that with a lot of the sprinters out of the race, the responsibility fell more on Bora Hansgrohe to bring that very strong break back.
Well, yeah, I spoke to Brian Holm this morning about the fact that Fernando Gaviria were pulled out of the Tour yesterday. Now, he's riding his first Tour, won 2 stages already, and would have been up there today, but the mountains have really caught the sprinters out en masse, hasn't it? And, you know, time limits have been not terribly generous, even when they've been extended. And Brian Holm made quite an interesting point about the time limit on the Alpe d'Huez stage.
I think there's just thing about the time card. I think they have to respect the riders, even a reasonable good rider, climber, as Greipel, he's a good climber. When he cannot finish it, it's too tight. I think you need a bit of respect for the riders also, and I didn't see that yesterday. You can say the superstars were out, yeah, but then some new superstars will be born. I don't think the next bunch sprint would be more boring because they're out, to be honest, because it still be exciting, maybe more exciting now, because it looked like Gaviria was way the fastest before, and then Groenewegen. And now it's going to be, wow, who's going to win now? Christophe, he's going to put like a victory off the top hat. Sagan gonna be good, even Demar always good for a stage win. Christophe, you know, it's gonna be exciting.
Who's gonna do the chasing today? You don't have to. Lotto NL Jumbo don't have to, so other teams will have to step up.
And they will. They should. I mean, they're gonna control each other. Francais des Jeux, UAE, Trek with Degenkolb. They're gonna look for each other, like we would have done. They're gonna block each other. 5-6 riders away, they're gonna pull them back. 20 riders, let them go.
Lastly, we understand this is your final Tour de France as a sports director. When did you make that decision and why?
As always, I was thinking about it last year, and I always said like wife and kids could spoil a good professional, and as I realized also as sports director. And to be honest, I started already last year to miss my family a bit. I've never ever been on holiday with my family. I mean, it's always you're traveling, you're working a lot. I love every second I've been at the Tour de France the last 20 years. But everything life starting is going to end also. And I like the idea of like, no, I don't like it. I'm a bit nervous about stopping. I'm traveling normally 150, 200 days a year. And it's quite stressful to suddenly get home. Doesn't have to travel anymore. If I stop totally, I hope I can continue half program with the team.
Yeah.
But the tour, you know, is like over. I mean, it's I've done it. I love it. But I think I like it also to see it from television.
So you'd like to carry on with the team, but do a lighter race program, maybe week-long stage races, but not the Grand Tours?
Exactly. If I can continue one-week races, and honestly, just to have a life next to cycling. I mean, in the springtime, I maybe have five weeks when I'm not home a weekend. I mean, I hardly never see my family. And, you know, it's a bit strange. You're living like in a bubble, and I love it, but I think I have to stop also to just... I mean, get home having a normal life like people do. Maybe I even get on Facebook, you know, like people is doing. Have dinners with the family, you know, being home for Easter, you know, and just normal stuff. I mean, it's you have to get used to sort of doing it, because when you lived like that many years, you never did anything else. But I'm looking forward to go for a bike ride with my son, like normal people does.
A bike ride with your son in the morning and then watch the Tour de France on TV in the afternoon.
Yeah, drinking tea and eating cookies. It's not bad.
He's always got an interesting point of view, Brian. The fact that they wanted to clarify the time cut on the Alpe d'Huez stage. They thought maybe a mistake had been made, but no. I mean, it wasn't a terribly generous time cut. And then towards the end there, Brian confirming that this is his last Tour de France. So that was news to me this morning anyway.
I spoke to another team boss, another guy who's lost his sprinter, Doug Ryder of Dimension Data. Mark Cavendish, of course, eliminated a couple of days ago. He had some interesting thoughts on, well, the way that the sport is changing, you know, where there's increasing specialisation, and that could be counting against the sprinters, coupled with the shortest stages, which make the time cuts even harder for them to meet. So here's Doug Ryder at the start this morning. Doug, I mean, the tour sort of carries on now without most of the top sprinters. Most of them have been lost the last couple of days, including Mark Cavendish. Is there a particular reason why that seems to be happening more?
The stages being shorter, with so much elevation gain happening, you know, in a stage as well, cramming so many mountains together, not giving the sprinters an opportunity to make up time, and the fact that that pro riders now are using every meter of the road as a competitive advantage. You know, in the past, the downhills used to be fairly casual, and they used to, you know, go down them quickly, but not like now. I mean, if you look last year at the Tour de France, Richie Porte crashing on that descent, the other guys in the GC knowing that he's not the best descender, leveraging that as an advantage, you know, then it becomes, every meter becomes, you know, an opportunity to make, gain, lose, whatever, time. So I think it's a combination of many things. And with the sprinters pushing bigger gears to go faster in the finals with stronger riders, that muscle damage that comes from pushing those bigger gears absolutely hurts them when it gets to the mountain stages. So I think, you know, it's like a double negative at the moment. You know, the shorter stages with lots of intensity in the mountains, and then of course you know, the sprinters wanting to be faster and having to be faster and training harder, being stronger, kind of like that weight and that gain and that muscle damage also hurts their chances of getting over the mountains.
It's I mean, in all sports we see greater specialization, but the Tour de France stage race is supposed to be for all-rounders, but we're seeing skinnier climbers and bulkier, heavier sprinters.
Yeah, I mean, I think now you're looking at riders like a Peter Sagan type guy, you know, that becomes the best sprinter of the race, and they're not the best sprinter in the world, in simple terms, I guess. So potentially going to have grand tours where you got to be an all-rounder, good at everything and potentially great at nothing, but, you know, just to get around. And that's quite sad, actually. So,
what's the solution? Is it the cutoff time? Is it how do you address that?
No, I think it is the cutoff time. I think that needs to be looked at so that you can keep guys in the race, especially when the stages are shorter. So there needs to be other circumstances that come into play, because I mean, a stage that's happening next week, that 60 odd kilometer stage. I mean, that when I was sitting next to Cavendish in the team presentation in October of the Tour de France, he was like, "I'll never get through that day. No sprinter will." I think it does need to, because the sprinters want to try and want to be there. So I think the time limit does need to be looked at, because the guys, of course, if they're messing around and having tea on the side of the road, you know, not trying to get to the finish, then that's one thing, right? But I mean, they're not. They're riding as hard as they can. So I think that needs to be looked at for sure.
Kiss goodbye to stomach cycling problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in sport, go energy isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the cycling podcast, as they have done for a while now. And they support you as well, the listeners, through their very generous discount offer of 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Now, we heard before the interval there from Doug Ryder talking about the difficulties that sprinters are having now.
There was a funny thing that happened towards the end of the stage, and I found that interesting, because it's a thing we didn't see for a long time. We saw Philippe Gilbert attack under the red flame with 1 kilometer to go. So when the sprinters, you know, field is depleted like it was today, it's sometimes maybe a chance for other type of riders. You know, I remember in the old days you had guys like Jelen Nijdam or others.
Jelen Nijdam. Is that a correct pronunciation?
I don't want to pronunciation
police.
We should ask Lionel. But I mean, these were the kind of guys. These were the kind of guys who, you know, could even a riders like Darrell Impey. I mean,
Thierry Marie, did he not do it as well?
Oh yeah, so some of the riders, you know, especially the pursuit specialists or guys, you know, or kilometer specialists. I mean, they would attack on the under the red flame and all the peloton at bay. We don't see these things happening much more, and you know, so much anymore. And I think it's a pity, because it was a way to win stages, which was interesting. A depleted field also meant that maybe we were some of the lead out guys could all of a sudden take prominent role in terms of the sprinters as themselves. But this morning I talked to Julien Alaphilippe about Richezze, who is the lead out man for Fernando Gaviria, and Julien told me, well, the problem is that these guys managed to make the time cut, they were absolutely shattered today. And Arnaud Demar, who was sacked third today, said he was on the verge of giving up throughout the stage today, because he was just absolutely exhausted after the efforts in the Alps. So, well, there's only one sprinter who climbs well in this Tour de France. His name is Peter Sagan.
This is the interesting thing, Richard, what Doug Ryder said, and until I heard that, I hadn't really considered it. You're right. The specialisation is going so extreme. The climbers now have to be absolutely skinny to the point of, well, I mean, they are skin and bone, aren't they? And the sprinters need that power, because
I mean, Dylan Groenewegen is very muscular. So is Fernando Gaviria. I mean, Sagan is the exception that proves the rule to everything, because he's also bulky and muscular. But, you know, he's a good all-rounder. Some of these other guys are far more limited in what they can do. They're specialists.
I think calling Peter Sagan a good all-rounder is a bit like describing Muhammad Ali as a decent boxer. I mean, he is a phenomenon, really. Yeah, I mean,
well, but Greg Van Avermaet was fifth today, so I mean, this, you know, there's still room for the versatile type of rider, because he can sprint, he can climb, and I mean, if you look at the result, except for the Grand Tours, these two guys, Greg Van Avermaet and Peter Sagan, are the two greatest riders in the peloton, and they were top five today.
I mean, Sagan was asked whether he thought he could win at Mons tomorrow, and you wouldn't rule it out. I mean, I don't think so, but
I don't think so.
But mate, he could win at Carcassonne, yeah. I would say, and then he could win at Pau, and then he could win on the Champs-Élysées. I mean, he's.
I like Francois's nostalgia there for these late attacks by the likes of Jelen Eidem, and the last one I can think of was Lucas Postelberger, who we heard from in the last part the Giro last year, when he just got a little gap and he was able to finish it off. And there are very few riders capable of doing that. Steve Cummings has done it as well, not at this tour, but guys with that turn of speed and that power, you know, they'd be good pursuiters as well, and can just sustain it for long enough. And Gilbert is a classic.
Tony Martin attempted these sort of things from time to time as well.
Now, throughout this Tour de France, we have been getting daily audio files from Ian Boswell, who's riding his first Tour de France. I'm not sure if that's Lionel's stomach or the
No, that's
thunder.
Not my stomach rumbling. That's thunder. It's a bit of a storm here in Valence.
A stormy Valence.
Yeah, the first rain of the tour, actually.
Mm.
Ian Boswell's been sending daily audio files with his diary from this Tour de France. He's doing that for a friend special that will come out after the tour. That's available to all of you who've signed up as friends of the podcast, which you can do at thecyclingpodcast.com. It costs £15 and you get lots of exclusive content. Just before the tour, we released a special with Jean Bobet, the star of the 1950s, whose brother won 3 Tours de France, Louison. That was great fun to do and a great honour to meet this guy who used to race with Fausto Coppi and the rest. And so that's available, along with about 10 or so other special episodes from this year. But very excited about the Boswell Journal. It's going to be good. And he's interviewed lots of people on his team. There's been lots going on in his team, with Kittel pulling out, Ilner Zakarin falling a bit short. And one guy who didn't survive the Alpe d'Huez stage was Rick Zabel, his German teammate and Kittel's lead-out man. Boswell did a little exit interview with Rick Zabel. Apologies for the bad language in this, but it conveys something, I think, of the, you know, not finishing a stage of the tour.
Yeah, yesterday was again race from kilometer zero, and we hit the Col de la Madeleine, and it exploded actually. So I was quite early dropped with a few guys, and 6-7 guys we was in our group, and I think everybody and our group did not finish. We all went into the room wagon at Quartier La Fère, like half of the race. And always a shit feeling for me. First time I do not finish a Grand Tour. But I also just have to say that these 3 days in the Alps was just, I was not good enough for it. Yeah. Quite simple.
Well, it's never easy to not finish a race. I've been in the broom wagon myself before, and there's always a feeling when someone jumps in, or I've been in a situation where you're in a group of 5 guys, 4 guys jump in, and you're like, well, do I keep riding, or now I'm by myself? Did you guys all jump in at the same time? I think there was a lot of German-speaking riders. Did you guys all say, okay, we stop here? You made like a group decision?
Yeah, kind of. Like, I was together with Greipel and Sieberg from Lotto Soudal, and we knew already we are quite far behind in the time. I think we had already like 15, 16 minutes at that point. It was just half of the race on the bottom, or like kind of the bottom, like we just was 5k into Quartier La Fère. So you had still 24k at Quartier La Fère, and then in the end 14k at Alpe d'Huez. And at the pace we are climbing, you already know, okay, I'm not going to make time cut today. Then it's even harder for your head to make it. And then like André is a guy I also really respect, and he was also like my fixed point yesterday. I said, okay, if I can stay with him, I should be fine. But he looked around to me and Sieberg, and he said, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, there's no way we're gonna make it. And do you guys want to keep riding? And I looked at him, and I'm like, no, actually not. Like, I'm done with this shit here. Like, really, this is bullshit. And then we stepped into the car. Grunewegen was already in there. Like 2 minutes later, Gaviria was also in there, because he was just a few meters up the road.
Yeah.
And then there was this discussion going on, oh, cool, Tour de France.
Yeah.
Makes the tour even harder than you have no sprinters anymore. Yeah. Really clever. So, yeah.
Very much looking forward to that, Richard. We'll be releasing that in the week after the tour, I think, when we'll be... Well, you'll be off at the Clásica San Sebastián, won't you?
Never stop, Lionel.
I'll be on holiday. Tomorrow, the stage at Mond, I love it at Mond. I don't know, it's just a nice finish? It's a press room in a tent, your favorite, Francois.
Yeah, it's usually, well, like tonight. I mean, hopefully this is the storm and we won't have it tomorrow, but it usually rains or threatens to rain. And when it does, the tent is in a field and, we get, kind of muddy, but there you are. The buffet is sometimes nice. So
the tour went to Mond last in 2015. Steve Cummings won there, as he said, Richard, ahead of Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet. It was a real victory for the roast beefs that day. Two against one, and they still managed to mess it up, eh, Francois?
Yeah, well, that day was credits and and congratulations to Steve Cummings. He could have been called Steve Cunning that day because he really kind of waited for, let's face it, Pinot and Bardet, they were all the rage at the time. There was, the French press were beefing up their rivalry. The one of them was poised to win the Tour one day. And here they are together with less than a kilometer to go until the finish line. And what did they do? They played it, track sprints. They waited, they waved around, they kind of... And what happened? Well, a guy came from behind. It was Steve Cummings. He won the stage. And our two Frenchies were absolutely...
Well, they were distraught. I remember them both being pretty distraught. But Peter Sagan was fifth that day. Bob Jungels was eighth. And Jonathan Castroviejo, riding for Movistar at the time, was ninth. So we're not going to see him up the road trying to win the stage. But that gives you the idea. It's a climb and a finish that will suit a very broad range of riders.
It's a 10-minute climb, but it's quite steep. My sense is it'll suit it'll suit Chris Froome and Romain Bardet more than Tom Dumoulin and Geraint Thomas. Mm-hmm. But...
Dan Martin, he has nothing to lose. Yeah.
And Valverde, maybe. I think it's a very interesting stage for it. It's the Massif Central. Sometimes these stages end up being the hardest of the race. I mean, if a team takes it on, AG2R depleted, but they're the sort of team who could have done some damage. They can't with their reduced numbers, perhaps. But Movistar, maybe not out of it, I I'm sorry that Nibali's not here because it's maybe the kind of day where he would have taken
sure,
it on.
But still, you never see great gaps on in that climb. No. It's been used often in Paris-Nice and others. So I've been up there many times. My impression is today is probably the best chance for a breakaway that's left. So I guess a few Thomas de Gendt was in the breakaway today, but guys like him, Sylvain Chavanel or others, they really have. If you have a strong breakaway with strong riders, could go all the way. And I'm pretty sure the GS contenders will battle it out on the climb. But even if someone like Dan Martin or whoever, Alejandro Valverde, was to win up there, I don't think the gaps will be in seconds between the GS contenders, and it'll be a nice little battle at the finish. But no impact normally on the GS.
Well, we'll be there. Richard, are you going in your helicopter trip tomorrow? I can't. No, you're not. You're not going in the helicopter, are you?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Lionel, but I am spending the day with Andy Schleck, who is driving VIPs on the Tour de France. And so I'm spending the day with him. I mean, quite odd to see him around. 2010 winner after Alberto Contador was stripped of the title. And that'll be for an episode of Kilometre Zero next week. So looking forward to that. And today's Kilometre Zero was your Dutch Corner episode.
Already mentioned that, but thanks for the second mention again. Yeah. We've got a couple of crackers early next week by Ola Shenoui.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
We'll reveal a bit more about that after the weekend.
Let's wrap it up.
Indeed.
Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Francois.
So my last bit of French flavour as usual. What did you have for lunch this morning, guys?
Did we have any lunch? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we had lunch. What did you have?
Cayette.
Cayette, yeah. Mm. So one of the local specialties, well, a very good one if you're into... it's not low cholesterol at all. It's kind of fat, but it's cayette. Cayette is made of pork, salads, and herbs. And how did you find it?
I thought it was delicious.
Yeah, it was nice.
Very nice indeed.
I didn't have the mustard sauce on mine. I probably should have done.
It looked heavy, but it was quite light. I enjoyed it. Another bit of cycling trivia. We came through Grenoble today, and Dave Brailsford, when he was... when he came to France to try and become a professional cyclist, landed in Grenoble and spent the night at the Grenoble station, slept on the platform, got the train the next day to meet his father, who was an alpine guide in a small village in the Alps, But some of these villages have, there are several places with the same name. Brailsford managed to get the train to the wrong village. It was actually in Switzerland. So he had to get the train back to Grenoble, spent a second night on the platform at the station in Grenoble, and then finally found his father the following day.
Oh, marginal trains.
Excellent.
Oh, bit different from these days, isn't it? Anyway, let's wrap things up. Sorry, Francois, did you have another bit of French flavour?
No, that's what I was about. I was just, you know, looking for... Well, if you're not into meat, you know, and this sort of things, there is another local dish that's from Romans and from all the area that's called ravioli. It's pretty close to ravioli, the Italian thing. It's only smaller and stuffed with cheese in general. So if you're around here, go for cayet if you're a meat eater. And if you're not, go for ravioli.
I'm going to do that tonight. Thank you, Francois.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré.